This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Psychotherapy has become completely absorbed into our current cultural climate, from popular entertainment like The Sopranos and In Therapy to the accessibility and familiarity of couples counseling and support groups. So why are the origins of psychotherapy still rarely known to anyone outside of the profession? Jonathan Engel aims to change that in the first comprehensive history of psychotherapy. The book is American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. Jonathan Engel joins me. He holds a PhD in the history of science and medicine from Yale University, and he's written extensively about the historical development of U.S. medicine and health policy. Jonathan, how are you, sir?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for spending some time with us. I've been looking forward to this. So the first question, Jonathan, for those who perhaps have never been in any kind of support group, have never laid on the couch, what is psychotherapy?
Sure. I mean, in its broadest way, it's just using talking between either one person in a professional or one person in a group, to get at the roots of some emotional issues. We all have problems as we go through life. Even the healthiest among us have tough times. And some of us can get through them on our own, and others of us need some help. And psychotherapy uses talk to get at it. There's lots and lots of different ways to go about it. Psychotherapy could be pastoral counseling. It could be an Alcoholics Anonymous group. It could be intensive cognitive therapy with a psychologist. It could be classic Freudian psychoanalysis with an analyst 5 days a week. There's lots of different ways of getting at it. Group therapy's gotten quite popular. What I will say about it is it works.
That was my next question.
Does work. When we survey people, we find that about two-thirds express some improvement, in fact, a fair amount of improvement after about 6 months. So a third don't, but about two-thirds will express satisfaction improvement. And that's pretty consistent over time. We've done a lot of outcome studies on this.
So where did it come from? Is it an American thing?
That's an interesting question. You know, it's not really invented here, but Americans have always embraced it with far more enthusiasm than really anybody else. You know, where does it come from? You could argue that it goes back to Catholic confessional, sort of that idea of venting, the catharsis that comes from just articulating and verbalizing what you've done wrong and what you're feeling guilty about. I'm not quite sure I would call that psychotherapy, but the roots of it are there, that understanding that there's a certain amount of health to be gained by simply verbalizing and owning up to stuff that's in your insides, and it seems to feel good, and there's a release associated with it. Most of us think about the roots of modern-day psychotherapy going back to Sigmund Freud, and I mean, almost everyone has heard of Sigmund Freud at this point. He was a neurologist. He lived in Vienna at the end of the 19th century, and he got very, very interested in hypnotism. Hypnotism was sort of all the rage in Europe at that time, and he was very interested in the idea that you could put someone into kind of a twilight sleep, and that they could say things, they could recall things that, were they conscious, they wouldn't be able to recall. And he just found this fascinating, this idea that they were parts of your memory and parts of your psyche that were definitely there, they existed, but they were unavailable to your conscience. And that whole idea of an unconscious, or that subconscious part of your mind, that's very Freudian. Freud essentially discovered the unconscious, and he decided that there were things that were lodged in the unconscious that could cause havoc, old memories, old thoughts, old feelings, that even though you thought they were safely buried away there, you might not have even been aware they were there.
And was that all new to him?
I mean, remarkably new.
I mean, did he invent that out of whole cloth?
Freud was wrong about a lot of things, so I don't want this to be, you know, to deify Freud. But he was an extraordinarily original thinker. You know, when you read Freud's writings, he did consult with people. He had a friend named Joseph Breuer, who also had some of the same ideas as he did. But largely, he came up with this on his own. And one of the things that made Freud so powerful was that he was a very, very good writer. He wrote well, and he enjoyed writing. And he wrote about 3 shelf feet of space. I mean, that's the complete Sigmund Freud works. Takes up 2.5 to 3 feet on your bookshelf. And it's very readable. I mean, even if you pick it up today, just a layman, you don't need to be a psychologist, you will find that it's very readable, very accessible, very, very clear. He just had a real gift with a pen, and he was also a good organizer. So besides having these very original ideas about the psyche, he had a way of transmitting his ideas that was very appealing. And that really took off, really, in the United States.
We're talking with Jonathan Engel. The new book is American Therapy, The Rise of the Psychotherapy in the United States. Jonathan is a professor of healthcare policy and management at Seton Hall University. He holds a PhD in the history of science and medicine from Yale. Jonathan, before we leave Freud, where was he most right And where was he most wrong,
I
think?
That's interesting. So I would say he was most right, A, in his idea that the unconscious exists, that there's stuff that you're not aware of that can cause you trouble. And B, with a basic understanding that talk, that really nothing more than talk, can bring that to the surface and that it can allow you to own it. So, you know, those are two ideas that were really original to Freud and that we continue to draw on today. Almost all psychotherapists will buy that to some degree, that there's some value in going back and trying to explore these old ideas and old memories. He was wrong about a lot of things, however. First of all, he was very, very focused on sex and sexuality and kind of traumatic ideas about sex. And there just doesn't seem to be a lot of currency to that. He had this idea that the infants had all sorts of sexual feelings and urges that were repressed. In fact, there's all the neurological evidence today suggests that human beings are not even able to form memories before about age two. So this idea that they're repressed infantile memory is just, it can't be, it just simply can't be true. You cannot remember things when you're one or one and a half because those memory parts of the brain have not really been wired down yet. They've not been formed. I think he got a lot of that wrong. A lot of his issues about gender, I think, were really off. And his basic technique has been largely discredited. He came up with this idea of what we all call psychoanalysis today. I mean, he called it psychoanalysis. And it was very rigid and very orthodox. It had to do with lying down on a couch. It was almost like out of a Woody Allen movie, right?
Yeah.
You know, lying down on a couch 5 days a week, staring at the ceiling, talking. The analyst is out of sight, taking notes. This goes on for months and months and years. And little by little, you achieve sort of complete insight into your own guts. And it's not a very good way of going about this. First of all, it takes too long. Second of all, it's much too expensive. And third of all, it doesn't even particularly work very well. So therapists started with this idea of talk, you know, this idea of talk, but then really have become far more pragmatic and goal-oriented and are just much better at getting to the roots of issues and achieving results. Today, therapists are far more results-oriented than Freud was.
Jonathan Engel is the author of American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States, the very first comprehensive history of American psychotherapy, and we're going to be giving away a copy of his book at the end of this interview. And so what happened to Freud?
And a toaster.
Yeah. What happened to Freud? Where did he end up?
Freud ended up unless he had to flee Europe. He was Jewish. He had to flee Europe in 1938 with his family, wound up in Europe, and he died a year later. But he left quite a legacy. He was an empire builder, and he'd built these psychoanalytic societies all over the world. And the big one in New York, there were actually two competing ones in New York City that governed American. One was the New York Psychoanalytic Society, and the other was the American Psychoanalytic Association. And those really defined American psychoanalysis. And the interesting thing about Freud is how long the influence lasted. Even though as early as the 50s, there was evidence that this was not a particularly effective way at healing people, at getting at people who were anxious or depressed. I mean, there was all sorts of outcome studies. In fact, they go as far back as 1928. There were some outcome studies that were done in Berlin that just showed it didn't seem to work very well. And despite that, it continued to rise in stature so that although the majority of American psychiatrists were never analysts, only about one out of six at its height were trained in analysis, they tended to be disproportionately influential in the profession. They tended to chair academic departments of psychiatry. They really governed the profession. There was a sense that they were really kind of a super tier of psychiatrists. And then for a long time, psychiatry, that's a branch of medicine, psychiatrists have an MD, really dictated the how and why of mental health care. So psychologists and social workers didn't come along until much later, and when they did come along, they were decidedly second-class citizens compared to the psychiatrists. That's all changed greatly. Almost no psychiatrist is doing any psychotherapy today, far less five-day-a-week psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
There's all the outcomes research seems to suggest that it doesn't really matter all that much what kind of training the therapist got. There are very effective therapists who are social workers, who are licensed family therapists, who are PhD psychologists. I mean, good therapists come in all shapes and colors, and that no one profession really seems to have a lock on it.
The book is American Therapy. It's the first comprehensive history of psychotherapy in the United States. We're talking with author Jonathan Engel, who is a professor of healthcare policy and management at Seton Hall. So, Jonathan, how do we go from Freud and the one guy with the couch to, like, AA meetings? And this, they have groups now for everything you
can
think of.
Sure, there's groups, right. So, by the way, the group therapy is uniquely American. Not surprisingly, Americans love to join things. And Americans have been joining things since the 19th century. De Tocqueville commented on this when he came to visit. He noticed that Americans were joiners. They joined the Masons and the Rotarians and the Elks and the Mooses and all these different things. And Americans love these things. And Americans also go to church, by the way, a lot more than Europeans. Americans do these days. So Americans continue to like to come together in these groups and group organizations and civic associations. And group therapy does, to some degree, seem to grow out of that. And it partially grows out of the fact that a great many people wound up in therapy or wind up in therapy not because they have terrible depression or anxiety, but because they have a very hard time maintaining healthy relationships and friendships and intimate relationships. And they come into the therapist's office, and what therapists started to notice was it was one thing to go about and try to examine your own feelings about intimacy and why people were getting into the wrong relationships. But ultimately, you had to give someone skills. You actually had to practice interpersonal skills, and you couldn't do that unless there were other people in the room. So why not put a bunch of people into the room, all of whom are having some issues in this regard, and get them to talk to each other and discuss with each other how they're relating to each other, and they can actually kind of confront each other. And in the course of confronting each other, they actually begin to gain some insight into their own patterns of interpersonal relationships. So that really started in about the late 1950s, and group therapy was really taken. It was embraced in the United States with greater enthusiasm than really anywhere else. There's a lot of it going on. One of the added advantages of group therapy, by the way, is that it happens to be cheaper because it's seven or eight people splitting the cost of the therapist instead of one-on-one. The therapists like it because, frankly, in a certain way, it's a little bit less work for them. You know, they don't have to do all the talking.
Yeah.
And people seem to like it. It's a little less intense than one-on-one. So in many ways, it's been very helpful. Now, I would quickly add that for some people, it's a way around doing the tough work. If part of what you need to do is really dig a little deep and dredge up some very difficult memories, being in a group situation may allow you to avoid that, whereas it's more difficult to avoid it one-on-one. But if what you need help with is learning some better interpersonal skills and kind of examining the way you yourself behave in a group situation, it can be very, very helpful.
We're talking with Jonathan Engel. The book is American Therapy. Tell us, and I guess the top tier, most famous of those group therapies would be AA, right?
AA, right. So it was one of the things I think I went out on a limb a little bit. Let me go back. When I started to write the book, I asked one of the questions, why do people wind up in therapy? And today, the single largest reason why people wind up in therapy is because of substance abuse and substance abuse counseling.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Alcoholism is a major problem. About 12% of the U.S. adult population are alcoholic by some definition. We're on slightly on the low end, by the way. The high end would be Russia, where it's almost a third of the adult population.
Wow, gosh.
And England and Ireland are well ahead of us. We're about where France and Italy are. Okay, so, you know, I don't know if you want to take comfort in that or not. But there's an awful lot of people out there who have trouble with drink and essentially need to drink every day. That's kind of the definition of an alcoholic, someone who can't control their drinking. And many, many people obviously have substance abuse issues, whether it's narcotics or painkillers or whatever it may be, and they also wind up in therapy. And one of the things that therapists noticed at an early point was that they could not seem to treat this, that this is all but untreatable by conventional means. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been one of the few groups, it's really the preeminent group in terms of treating alcohol abuse. The Narcotics Anonymous kind of took off for that, for narcotics abuse. And Alcoholics Anonymous is fascinating. It's a fascinating institution. It has been uniquely successful. About half the people who go to AA will eventually get their drinking under control. Might not happen right away. There might be some backsliding, some recidivism, but roughly 50% of the people who walk into an AA meeting of their own volition will ultimately get their drinking under control.
That's
far better success rate than really anything else.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
it's
amazing. And on one hand, AA is simply sort of a weird, very populist form of group therapy. You're in a group situation. What goes on in AA meetings? You talk. That's really all there is to it. There's no medication. It's talk. It's talking to peers. But it's a funny kind of talk. First of all, you're talking to essentially people who are peers. That is, everyone in that room has been or is currently an alcoholic. I mean, I guess they would say they still are an alcoholic, they're a recovered alcoholic, right? So everyone in that room can confront you with a degree of honesty that a non-alcoholic cannot, because they won't buy your rationalizations.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that one of the things that happens through Alcoholics Anonymous is you actually, to some degree, sacrifice your old life to take on a new life. One of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous understands is that there's something that drove you to drink. There's aspects of your life that aren't working. And in order for you to stop drinking, you're going to have to change your life. It's not enough to just stop drinking but keep everything else in your life the same. Something else has to change, and often everything has to change. Your friends, your family, your job, your life habits, your life goals, your religiosity. I mean, a lot of things may have to change to allow you ultimately to conquer alcoholism. And what AA does is it provides an alternative to that old life. What they're saying is, yes, you are going to have to give up your old life, which is very, very frightening, but here's a new life to jump to. We're here for you. We're always here for you. You can call us at 3 o'clock in the morning. We're here to talk to. We're here to have fun with. We're here to go to parties with. With no alcohol.
They're very busy during the holidays, too.
Right, so you got it. And, you know, I think some people have noted that nobody ever jumps from something into an abyss. You jump from one person's arms into another person's arms. That's why marriages don't break up until someone has an affair, right? You don't just get out of a bad marriage into nothing. You get out of a bad marriage to jump into a better relationship. And that's the same thing with alcohol. With alcoholism, you don't just give up drinking to jump into a vacuum. You give it up to jump into something that's more attractive, or at least that provides a soft landing. And AA provides that soft landing. And the other thing about AA, which I found absolutely fascinating, was the religious aspect of it. AA insists that famous 12-step method, the 12th step is you have to accept a higher power. Most people read that as God, but yeah, something godlike. And a lot of classic psychoanalysts and many psychotherapists are decidedly atheistic or anti-religious. They feel that there's almost a neurosis associated with religion. So they're very uncomfortable with that concept of AA. But AA insists on it, and I think they're right. What they find is that underlying alcohol abuse and drug abuse is an essential narcissism. There's an essential piece of you which says, I can do what I want when I want because it feels good and I'm allowed to do that. And the essence of religion says, no, you can't do what you want. There is something bigger than you, more important than you, and there are rules and obligations which you have to embrace that you may not understand, but they're simply obligations that come along with being a human being. And the two are in direct conflict. You cannot accept exterior obligations while at the same time believing that you are allowed to do whatever you want to do. And so I think it's that need to embrace something bigger, to accept that there's a larger force or a larger good than simply your own pleasure and utility in the world, that seems to be critical to the success of AA.
We're talking with Jonathan Engel. He has got a PhD in the history of science and medicine from Yale. He teaches at Seton Hall. The new book is American Therapy: The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. Jonathan, before we let you go, I've got to ask you about when I was a kid, I remember in the 1970s that there were all these kooky group therapy things like EST, I think, where they would block you in a room for the weekend.
Oh, yeah. So you must be about my age.
So tell us about those.
Right. Well, so I had a whole chapter in the book that originally I called kooky therapies, but I decided that was a little too provocative. But there was this flowering of these really off-the-wall therapies in the late 60s and early 70s. EST, Primal Scream, Rebirthing, all these encounter groups, Scientology. I sort of threw them all into the same thing, although they came out of different origins. I mean, for example, Zen Buddhism also really took off then, and I would also throw that into a kind of a weird derivative of psychotherapy. But, I mean, what was going on? Most of the stuff, by the way, we've since discarded. No one does Primal Scream anymore. Maybe there's three people left in Northern California doing it, and almost no one does EST anymore, and Scientology has been largely discredited. Although, I want to be careful when I say that. They're obviously Scientologists.
Yeah, they've got lawyers.
Yeah, I want to be careful there. There are clearly people were searching something for something and looking for something, and it sort of hit at that time. And I suspect when I was doing my research, I was trying to understand why that all seemed to happen at the same time. Part of it was just a larger acceptance of psychotherapy. There was a general understanding that this had been building really since the Second World War, that a lot of people just needed help, and that some of the social stigma associated with therapy were breaking down. More people were willing to try it. But the other thing going on right then, I think, was a real breakdown in social institutions. The divorce laws had just been changed, first in California and then elsewhere, so divorce was heavily on the rise. There was a fleeing from organized religion, so people really stopped going to church en masse after about 1962, 1963. You're suddenly seeing really declining church attendance. People were very mobile. They're moving around. This was kind of the corporate era and the organization man, so there's a lot of dislocation. So I think a lot of the traditional structures which really help people get through life, whether it's family or church or community, were breaking down, and people felt very unrooted and very lost. And they were looking for answers. And I think these weird therapies seem to provide some hope. And here's the weird thing, Coy. They all sound very weird to us today, like Primal Scream or Rebirthing. Yeah. And yet, if you interviewed people and asked some people who undertook these therapies 35 years ago, some of them will tell you they found them helpful. I mean, as weird as they sounded, someone out there definitely found something helpful. I mean, which just goes to show you that a lot of therapy is finding the right therapy for you.
Yeah, and I guess that's one message that let's leave it at, is that there is help out there. Because there's a lot of people out there who are looking for help, and a lot of people out there who may not know that they even need help.
Absolutely.
But it's out there.
There's a lot of good therapists out there. Most people who use therapy are satisfied with it. The one thing I sort of emphasize this in the last chapter of the book, the one thing that's come across again and again in trying to understand why some therapy is successful and some isn't, is this notion of empathy. There has to be a connection, a trust between the therapist and the patient. And that's going to be a little bit unique to each patient. So the person who was a good therapist for your brother-in-law or your friend might not be the right therapist for you. So
right.
If you're someone looking for therapy and it doesn't seem to be working, you're seeing someone for a couple weeks and it's not getting anywhere, throw them out and try someone else. It doesn't even mean they're a bad therapist. It just means they're not the right therapist for you.
Jonathan Ingle, the book is American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. It's actually a very fun book and fascinating. Jonathan, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.